Patients lose an extra 2.9 kilograms of body weight and keep it off. The main side effect of this class of medications is the increased risk of urinary tract infections and yeast infections due to increased urinary glucose concentration. However, these infections were generally mild and treatable. The most serious side effect was an increased risk of ketoacidosis. The combination of proven organ protection, lowered blood glucose, lowered insulin, and weight loss is a powerful incentive for physicians to prescribe these new drugs. Sales have been rising sharply as of 2017, with some analysts predicting that sales could hit $6 billion by 2020. Alpha-glucosidase inhibitors. Despite the hoopla, the SGLT2 was not actually the first oral hypoglycemic agent to show proven cardiovascular benefits. Another now largely forgotten drug was previously shown to have similar benefits. Acarbose is an oral diabetes medication first introduced in the United States in 1996. It blocks the enzymes alpha-glucosidase and alpha-amylase, both of which are required for proper digestion of carbohydrates. Blocking these enzymes prevents complex carbohydrates, which are chains of glucose, from breaking into smaller glucose molecules, thus reducing absorption. Acarbose is essentially the drug equivalent of a low-carbohydrate diet. The 2003 Study to Prevent Non-Insulin-Dependent Diabetes Mellitus, STOP-NIDM, trial showed that acarbose, despite relatively unimpressive lowering of blood glucose, reduced the risk of cardiovascular events by a remarkable 49% and hypertension by 34%. In addition to these unprecedented benefits, acarbose also reduced body weight by 1.41 kilograms and waist circumference by 0.79 centimeters. These results could have been predicted since blocking absorption of dietary carbohydrates would be expected to lower insulin levels. At the time of publication, the benefits were ascribed to the blood glucose lowering effect, and it was expected that more powerful blood glucose lowering medications would deliver even more impressive benefits. Yet by 2008, the ACCORD, ADVANCE, VADT, and ORIGIN trials had conclusively demonstrated no benefits to blood glucose lowering. Acarbose succeeded precisely where other medications failed because it reduces both glucotoxicity and insulin toxicity rather than trading one for the other. It is still widely used in China and parts of Asia due to its low cost, but is now far less popular in North America because its blood glucose lowering effect is less powerful and bloating is a bothersome side effect. Glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1 analogs. GLP-1 analogs are diabetic medications that mimic the effect of the incretin hormones. Normally, the incretins secreted by the stomach have several physiological roles when you eat food. They increase the release of insulin, but also slow down the motility of the stomach and increase satiety. The DPP-4 inhibitors also enhance incretin levels, but the GLP-1 analogs reach levels that are many times higher than normal. Incretins increase the insulin response to food, so blood glucose decreases after meals. This transitory rise in insulin is not enough to cause weight gain, but incretins slow the movement of food through the stomach, causing satiety, decreased food intake, and weight loss. It also accounts for the main side effect of nausea and vomiting. The 2016 LEADER trial of the GLP-1 analog, liraglutide, showed that nausea occurred 4 times more often in the drug group than the placebo group. Patients on the medication averaged 2.3 kilogram weight loss compared to placebo and lowered their A1C by 0.4%. The blood glucose lowering effect was fairly modest, but the cardiovascular benefits were not. Liraglutide could reduce cardiovascular disease and death by approximately 15%. While less powerful than the SGLT2 inhibitor class, or acarbose, it was still highly significant and promised clinical benefits. Yet again, the glucotoxicity paradigm was proved inadequate to explain what was happening. Clinical benefits only accrue when both glucotoxicity and insulin toxicity are reduced. A trade-off, not a solution. Standard medications for type 2 diabetes represent a trade-off between glucotoxicity and insulin toxicity. Insulin, TZDs, and SUs all increase insulin, or its effect, to reduce hyperglycemia. The effect of the increased insulin becomes clinically obvious as weight gain. The price of better glucose control has been higher insulin dosage, so there is no net benefit. These medications simply trade lower glucotoxicity for higher insulin toxicity. Metformin and DPP-4 medications use mechanisms other than raising insulin to lower blood glucose. But they do not lower insulin either, so the result is neither weight gain nor weight loss. Reducing glucotoxicity while keeping insulin neutral produces minimal benefits. Clinically, these medications are weight neutral, but also neutral with regard to cardiovascular risk or benefits. Acarbose, SGLT2 inhibitors, and GLP-1 analogs all lower glucose, but also lower insulin and cause weight loss. Since type 2 diabetes is a disease characterized by elevations in both blood glucose and blood insulin, these medications would be predicted to have the best outcome. And sure enough, that is the case. In a disease of too much insulin, lowering it creates benefits. These three categories of medications could easily be called the good, lowers insulin, body weight, and complications, the bad, neutral, and the ugly, increases insulin, body weight, and complications. See table 11.1 in the supplementary PDF. The classic oral hypoglycemic agents were exclusively those that were insulin neutral or raised insulin levels. This explains how meta-analyses reviewing all the available literature up to 2016, including 20 randomized controlled trials, could only conclude that there is no significant evidence of long-term efficacy of insulin on any clinical outcome in T2D, type 2 diabetes. However, there is a trend to clinically harmful adverse effects such as hypoglycemia and weight gain. In other words, insulin treatment, including medications that simulate only the blood glucose-lowering properties of insulin, carries no perceptible benefits and significant risks. Insulin is, quote, significantly more harmful than other active treatments. A similar review in the Journal of the American Medical Association that includes all relevant trials up to March 2016 found that none of the drug classes considered, including metformin, SUs, TZDs, and DPP-4 inhibitors, reduce cardiovascular disease or other complications. Importantly, these older medications did not reduce the hyperinsulinemia that is the root problem, or indeed made it worse. Again, diabetes will continue unless we treat the root cause. While the scientific evidence is crystal clear, diabetes guidelines are slow to reflect this new reality. Dr. Victor Montori of the Mayo Clinic discovered that 95% of published guidelines endorse the use of diabetes drugs despite their non-existent benefits. Why would you take medications that have no benefits? Worse, why would you take medications that have no benefits and make you fat? The classic medical treatment, which relies almost exclusively on pharmaceuticals to reduce blood glucose, can therefore best be described as how not to treat type 2 diabetes. By contrast, newer agents, which can reduce both blood glucose and insulin levels, show proven benefits to reduce heart and kidney complications of type 2 diabetes. Nevertheless, these medications, while an important step forward, are clearly not the answer. They do not reverse the root cause of type 2 diabetes, our diet. Following a low-fat, calorie-restricted diet and increasing exercise have long been the recommended lifestyle treatment for type 2 diabetes. There is only one problem with this seemingly common sense advice. It doesn't work at all. Chapter 12. Low-calorie diets and exercise, not the answer. In 2015, when Dr. Sarah Hallberg stepped onto the stage at Purdue University to deliver a TEDx talk about reversing diabetes, few in the audience expected to hear what she was about to say. Reversing type 2 diabetes starts with ignoring the guidelines. Dr. Hallberg is the medical director of Indiana University's weight loss program, and she argued convincingly that the low-fat diet endorsed by the American Diabetes Association, ADA, and countless medical organizations was almost exactly wrong. These experts were hurting the very patients they hoped to help. Instead, a simple dietary change had the potential to significantly improve diabetes and help weight loss efforts. Her lecture soon became an internet sensation, quickly passing a million views, and she was featured on radio and television, and on the front page of the New York Times Sunday Review. Her powerful message of hope had struck a chord. And why? Because it made sense. So, what exactly are these guidelines that we should ignore? The low-fat era. In the early 2000s, the monumental task of recommending an optimal diet for type 2 diabetics was assigned to Dr. Richard Kahn, then the chief medical and scientific officer of the ADA. Like any good scientist, he began by reviewing the available published data. When you look at the literature, whoa, is it weak. It is so weak, he said. But that was not an answer the ADA could give. People demanded dietary advice. So, without any evidence to guide him one way or the other, Dr. Kahn went with the generic advice given to the public at large, to eat a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. It's a diet for all America, he reasoned. Therefore, it should be good for type 2 diabetics, too. And where did that advice come from? In the U.S., the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs first released its dietary guidelines for Americans in 1977. Since 1980, the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, and the Department of Health and Human Services have published a set of dietary guidelines every 5 years. And in Canada, the federal government has been regularly publishing and updating a food guide since 1942. The food pyramids published in these guides have been informing our food choices and doctors' recommendations ever since. And the foods at the base of the pyramid, the ones to be eaten preferentially, have been grains and other refined carbohydrates. The bread, rice, cereal, and pasta group, of which we were supposed to eat 6 to 11 servings daily, comprise the exact foods that cause the greatest increase in blood glucose. This is also the precise diet that has failed to halt the greatest obesity and type 2 diabetes epidemics the world has ever seen. But let's talk specifically about type 2 diabetes by juxtaposing two incontrovertible facts. One, type 2 diabetes is characterized by high blood glucose. Two, refined carbohydrates raise blood glucose levels more than any other foods. So, type 2 diabetics should eat the very foods that raise blood glucose the most? Illogical is the only word that comes to mind. Yet, not just the USDA, but also the Diabetes UK, European Association for the Study of Diabetes, EASD, Canadian Diabetes Association, American Heart Association, and National Cholesterol Education Panel recommended fairly similar diets. All of them suggested keeping carbohydrates at a lofty 50 to 60% of total calories and dietary fat at less than 30%. The 2008 American Diabetes Association position statement on nutrition advised, "Dietary strategies including reduced calories and reduced intake of dietary fat, can reduce the risk for developing diabetes and are therefore recommended. The logic is hard to follow. Dietary fat does not raise blood glucose. Reducing fat to emphasize carbohydrates, which are known to raise blood glucose, could protect against diabetes? How they believe that would work is unknown. It further advised, against all common sense, that intake of sucrose and sucrose-containing foods by people with diabetes does not need to be restricted. Eating sugar was okay for type 2 diabetics? This could not realistically be expected to lower blood glucose, and the proof came soon enough. Why the low-fat era backfired. The 2012 treatment options for type 2 diabetes in adolescents and youths today, randomized study, reduced caloric intake to a minuscule 1,200 to 1,500 calories per day of a low-fat diet combined with increased exercise. This followed precisely the recommendations made by the 2008 ADA guidelines. Intensive dietary counseling was provided to ensure compliance in this group of motivated teenagers. Massive effort by both patients and study staff failed to improve blood glucose, and the failure rate was astronomically high. Almost 50% of patients required increased doses and numbers of medications. Whether or not patients followed the recommended lifestyle recommendations did not matter at all. Regardless, their diabetes was getting worse, not better. The scariest part of the study was that if these teenagers couldn't do it, what hope did middle-aged or elderly adults have? This classic eat less, move more strategy failed yet again. But the fact that this diet would not work should have been fairly obvious from the beginning. Reducing dietary fat means increasing dietary carbohydrates, since it is difficult to eat protein alone. In the westernized world, these carbohydrates were not leafy greens, but the refined grains and sugars that increase blood glucose and insulin maximally. What was certainly behind the recommendation of a low-fat diet was the belief that lowering dietary fat could protect against heart disease and stroke. The most common cause of death in type 2 diabetes is cardiovascular disease, which had been falsely attributed to dietary fat. It must surely have been predicted that diabetes would worsen on this low-fat but high-carbohydrate regimen, but presumably the benefits were felt to be worth this risk. Upon closer inspection, these illusory benefits burst like a ripe abscess. By 1997, the Nurses' Health Study, see Chapter 4, a massive observational study from Harvard University, found no relationship between dietary fat or dietary cholesterol and heart disease. The final nail in the coffin was the 2006 Women's Health Initiative, also in Chapter 4. Almost 50,000 women followed this low-fat, calorie-reduced diet for more than 8 years, yet the rates of heart disease and stroke did not improve whatsoever. And despite good compliance with years of calorie restriction, on average, women lost less than a quarter of a pound. There were absolutely no tangible benefits to long-term compliance with a low-fat diet. Other studies quickly reached the same conclusions. Despite 40 years of research trying to link dietary fat, dietary cholesterol, and heart disease, not a single shred of evidence could be found. In diabetic patients, the story was the same. The Action for Health and Diabetes, Look Ahead, clinical trial studied more than 5,000 obese patients with type 2 diabetes at 16 sites across the U.S. The researchers compared a control group receiving standard diabetes intervention with a second group that ate only 1,200 to 1,800 calories per day, less than 30% of them from fat, and did 175 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity. This was the recommended intensive lifestyle intervention of every diabetes association in the world. Would it reduce heart disease as promised? In a word, no. In 2012, the trial was stopped early after 9.6 years of high hopes. The data indicated there was no chance patients would show cardiovascular benefits, and continuing the study was futile. Researchers threw in the towel. The low-fat, calorie-reduced diet had failed yet again. All the scientific evidence has consistently refuted the dearly held belief that reducing dietary fat would lead to weight loss and reduce heart disease. Finally, the 2015 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, the most recent, have removed the limits on dietary fat intake to reflect this new understanding, recognizing that there are a number of healthy fats, such as those found in olive oil, nuts, and avocados. The low-fat, calorie-reduced diet was a bust. The exercise approach. Lifestyle interventions, typically a combination of diet and exercise, are a universally acknowledged mainstay of type 2 diabetes treatments. These two stalwarts are often portrayed as equally beneficial, and why not? Exercise improves weight loss efforts, although its effects are much more modest than most assume. Nevertheless, physical inactivity is an independent risk factor for more than 25 chronic diseases, including type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Low levels of physical activity in obese subjects are a better predictor of death than cholesterol levels, smoking status, or blood pressure. And the benefits of exercise extend far beyond simple weight loss. Exercise programs improve strength and balance, blood pressure, cholesterol, blood glucose, and insulin sensitivity without involving medications and their potential side effects. Trained athletes have consistently lower insulin levels, and these benefits can be maintained for life, as demonstrated by many studies on older athletes. These seem like good returns for a low-cost investment. Yet results of both aerobic and resistance exercise studies in type 2 diabetes are varied. Meta-analyses show that exercise may significantly reduce A1C without a change in body mass. This finding suggests that exercise does not need to reduce body weight to have benefits, which echoes clinical experience with patients. However, the corollary is that exercise programs have minimal effect for weight loss. With all the proven benefits of exercise, it may surprise you to learn that I think this is not useful information. Why not? Because everybody already knows this. The benefits of exercise have been extolled relentlessly for the past 40 years. I have yet to meet a single person who has not already understood that exercise might help type 2 diabetes and heart disease. If people already know its importance, what is the point of telling them again? The main problem has always been non-compliance. Many real issues may deter someone from embarking on an exercise program. Obesity itself, joint pain, neuropathy, peripheral vascular disease, back pain, and heart disease may all combine to make exercise difficult or even unsafe. Overall, however, I suspect the biggest issue is lack of visible results. The benefits are greatly overhyped, and exercise doesn't work nearly as well as advertised. Weight loss is often minimal. This lack of results, despite great effort, is demoralizing. The disappointing impact of exercise. Conceptually, exercise seems like an ideal way to burn off the excess ingested calories of glucose. Standard recommendations are to exercise 30 minutes per day, 5 days per week, for a total of 150 minutes per week. At a modest pace, the result is an extra energy expenditure of 150 to 200 kilocalories per day, or 700 to 1,000 kilocalories per week. These amounts pale in comparison to a total energy intake of 14,000 calories per week. In studies, all exercise programs produce substantially fewer benefits than expected. There are two main reasons. First, exercise is known to stimulate appetite. This tendency to eat more after exercise reduces expected weight loss. Second, a formal exercise program tends to decrease non-exercise activity. For example, if you have been doing hard physical labor all day, you are unlikely to come home and run 10 kilometers for fun. On the other hand, if you've been sitting in front of the computer all day, that 10-kilometer run might sound pretty good. These compensation effects are a well-described phenomenon in exercise studies. As you increase exercise intensity or duration, you may find that you eat more or do fewer other non-exercise activities. These compensations directly reduce the beneficial effects of the exercise program. In the end, the main problem is that type 2 diabetes is not caused by lack of exercise. The underlying problem is excessive dietary glucose and fructose, causing hyperinsulinemia. Exercise can only improve insulin resistance of the muscles. It does not improve insulin resistance in the liver at all. The fatty liver is the key to developing type 2 diabetes, and you cannot exercise your liver to health. Reversing type 2 diabetes depends upon treating the root cause of the disease, which is dietary. Imagine that you turn on your bathroom faucet full blast. The sink starts to fill quickly because the drain is small. Widening the drain slightly is not the solution because it does not address the underlying problem. The obvious solution is to turn off the faucet. In type 2 diabetes, a diet full of refined carbohydrates and sugars is filling our bodies quickly with glucose and fructose. Widening the drain by exercising is minimally effective. The obvious solution is to turn off the faucet. And that leads us to the next section, how to effectively treat type 2 diabetes. Elena. Elena, 63, was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes 3 years before I met her. She also had a history of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and obesity, the classic manifestations of metabolic syndrome, and evidence of fatty liver damage. She was taking metformin for diabetes, as well as medications to lower her blood pressure and cholesterol. Her A1C was 6.2%. When Elena joined the IDM program, we discussed low-carbohydrate, healthy-fat diets, and she began a fasting regimen of 36 hours 3 times per week. Having long been told to eat frequent small meals throughout the day, fasting required a new mindset. Within 2 weeks of starting the program, however, she was able to stop taking metformin. A year after she began, she also stopped taking hypertension medication, as her blood pressure had normalized. At our last meeting, her A1C was 5.2%, which is well within the normal range. Today, Elena is considered non-diabetic. The blood markers that indicate liver damage have completely normalized, meaning she no longer suffers from the fatty liver that causes chronic liver damage. Furthermore, she has dropped 60 pounds, lost 24 centimeters off her waist, and completely reversed her metabolic syndrome. Richard. Richard, 76, was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes about a decade ago. In addition, he had high blood pressure, stroke, peripheral vascular disease, an irregular heartbeat, atrial fibrillation, and chronic kidney disease. 6 years later, he started on insulin, 36 units daily, in addition to 2 oral hypoglycemics, yet his A1C remained elevated at 8.4%. I met Richard just after he started taking insulin. Following the IDM program, he began a low-carbohydrate, healthy-fat diet and a 24-hour fast 3 days per week. Within a month, he was off insulin, and after 6 months, he was completely off all his oral medications as well. His urine albumin to creatinine ratio, a measure of diabetic kidney damage, dropped by 2/3. He lost 13 pounds, and his waist size shrank by 12 centimeters. Today, Richard's A1C is 5.4% without medications, which classifies him as non-diabetic. Part 5. How to effectively treat type 2 diabetes. Chapter 13. Lessons from bariatric surgery. At 203 kilograms, 448 pounds, Adrian was morbidly obese and suffered from type 2 diabetes. Medically unfit to work due to all his associated illnesses, he lost his job in 2014. He eventually chose to undertake weight loss surgery, also called bariatric surgery, and within 5 weeks, his diabetes had completely disappeared. Interestingly, this story of type 2 diabetes reversal is not the exception, but a general rule after surgery. How often have we heard type 2 diabetes called a chronic and progressive disease? This idea has only become accepted as if it were fact because we have spent decades treating the symptom, hyperglycemia, rather than the cause. Bariatric surgery proves that this notion is simply mistaken. Type 2 diabetes is a reversible and preventable disease. When we treat the cause, hyperinsulinemia, we can reverse diabetes. Remember Dr. Hallberg's advice in Chapter 12? Ignore the guidelines. What does bariatrics teach us about type 2 diabetes? Quite a lot, it turns out. Early attempts at weight loss surgery. The earliest attempt to surgically cure obesity was to simply wire the jaws shut. The logic is obvious, if not very imaginative. This restrictive treatment, though, was ultimately unsuccessful. Patients could still drink fluids, and enough high-calorie sugary drinks derailed weight loss. The severe side effects were the limiting factor. Dental infections and vomiting were insurmountable problems that often progressed over time. More often than not, these intolerable problems led to reversing the surgery. In 1925, The Lancet noted that partial removal of the stomach for peptic ulcer disease often caused weight loss and complete resolution of sugar in the urine, now called diabetes. The smaller stomach volume effectively reduced the amount a person could eat. Similar reports followed sporadically in the 1950s and 1960s. This was an interesting finding, but the results often did not endure. Over time, the smaller stomach could expand, and patients could eat normally. Weight would rebound, and with it, type 2 diabetes. Jejunocolic bypass surgery. The modern age of bariatric surgery began in 1963 with the observation that removal of the small bowel, which absorbs most of the ingested nutrients, caused significant weight loss. This led to the development of the jejunocolic bypass operation, in which bypassing the small bowel reroutes food from the stomach directly to the colon. Success. Patients lost significant amounts of weight using this malabsorptive approach. But the side effects became immediately obvious. Bypassing the small bowel did not allow the food to undergo the normal digestive process. This was the point. If the food passed right through, it could not hang around long enough to be absorbed and eventually stored as body fat. Instead, this food energy was immediately excreted in the stool. However, this rapid passage also meant essential food nutrients were not absorbed properly or at all. Patients developed night blindness from vitamin A deficiency and osteoporosis from vitamin D deficiency. Other common problems included severe diarrhea and bacterial overgrowth, liver failure, and kidney stones. The continual diarrhea from the malabsorbed fat led to anal excoriations and hemorrhoids. No fun. This procedure, too, was soon abandoned. Jejunoileal bypass. These complications forced the switch to the less intensive jejunoileal bypass, in which most, but not all, of the small bowel is bypassed by rerouting food from the stomach directly to a very short section of the small bowel. Although absorption improved slightly, the complications were still unacceptable, rendering this surgery a historical footnote. However, this incremental improvement allowed others to build upon these initial experiences. In 1967, the seed of modern bariatric surgical procedures was planted with the use of restrictive and malabsorptive components combined. This approach physically limited the intake of food by removing most of the stomach and also reduced the absorption of whatever food made it through. In addition to the partial bypass of the small bowel, part of the stomach was removed. With the basic idea in place, further refinements were added over time. Weight loss surgery today. Compared to the number of obese people in the United States, the number of bariatric surgeries remains very small. In 2015, approximately 200,000 weight loss surgeries were performed in the United States. Outside the U.S., this procedure is performed even less often, though there are few reliable statistics. Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. The standard form of bariatric surgery today is Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which takes its name from the creation of a blind loop of the small bowel that makes a Y shape of the small intestines. Most of the healthy stomach is removed until the only portion remaining is approximately the size of a walnut, which severely restricts food intake. By itself, this procedure serves as only a short-term solution, so the second step of the surgery involves rerouting the small intestine to prevent the absorption of most, but not all, of the ingested food. This combined restrictive and malabsorptive procedure makes the Roux-en-Y bypass the current heavyweight champion of bariatric surgeries, with the best weight loss, but also the most complications. The surgery has "Go Big or Go Home" tattooed on its massive bicep. In addition to the usual risks of bleeding and infection common to all surgeries, deficiencies of all nutrients, including proteins, vitamins, and minerals, can lead to lifelong malnutrition after the bypass. Gastric dumping syndrome, caused when food moves too quickly, is dumped from the surgically altered stomach to the small intestines, can cause nausea, diarrhea, and facial flushing after meals. Strictures, abnormal narrowings, due to scar tissue can occur at the surgical site and block the passage to the stomach. The Roux-en-Y surgery is often reserved for severe cases of obesity, typically patients with a body mass index greater than 40. The side effects, however, have led to the development of milder forms of bariatric surgery that can also produce spectacular results without the complexity or complications of the Roux-en-Y. The sleeve gastrectomy simply removes a large portion of the healthy stomach without altering the intestines, making it a purely restrictive form of weight loss surgery. It dramatically reduces the stomach's capacity for holding food. More than a thimbleful of food causes severe gastric distension, ballooning of the miniature stomach, and persistent nausea and vomiting. Over time, the remaining stomach stretches until it becomes possible to eat small meals. Since this procedure may be done laparoscopically, through a series of small incisions, there tend to be fewer acute surgical complications, such as bleeding and infection. Although gastric dumping syndrome is rare after this procedure, strictures are common. More importantly, perhaps, compared to the Roux-en-Y surgery, it leads to less weight loss and less durable results. The gastric lap band. An even simpler surgery is the surgically implanted gastric lap band that wraps around the stomach. Like cinching a tight belt, the lap band restricts food from entering the stomach. No part of the healthy stomach is removed, and the lap band can be gradually tightened or loosened as needed. Because of its relative simplicity, this procedure has the fewest complications and can be used by anybody for weight loss. The main problem is that weight is often regained over time. One surgeon, a friend, remarked that the most common lap band surgery these days is its removal. See figure 13.1 in the supplementary PDF. In the short term, all types of bariatric surgery have been proved effective for weight loss and diabetes. Longer term studies showed varied effectiveness, depending upon the type of surgery. However, I do not wish to praise or condemn any of these surgeries. As with everything else in medicine, they have their place. My main question is, what happens to type 2 diabetes after bariatric surgery? What does bariatric surgery teach us? Why bariatric surgery works. In virtually all cases, type 2 diabetes completely disappears after bariatric surgery. Type 2 diabetes is entirely reversible, even in a 500-pound patient with a 20-year duration of disease. It is not only reversible, but rapidly reversible. In a matter of weeks, the diabetes disappears. Yes, it truly just goes away. See figure 13.2 in the supplementary PDF. A 2012 trial called Surgical Treatment and Medications Potentially Eradicate Diabetes Efficiently Stampede, compared the effects of gastric bypass surgery with intensive medical therapy, drug treatments on obese type 2 diabetics with very high blood glucose levels. Surgical patients did amazingly well. Within 3 months, most patients stopped taking all their diabetic medications because their blood glucose had normalized, often long before they noticed substantial weight loss. Technically, these patients no longer had diabetes. In other words, type 2 diabetes is reversible, even curable. By contrast, the patients in the intensive medical therapy group experienced no improvement in their disease over time. They continued to require ever-increasing doses of medications for type 2 diabetes. Super obese adolescents with an average body mass index of 53 undergoing bariatric surgery have enjoyed the same success, maintaining a 90-pound weight loss over 3 years. High blood pressure resolved in 74% of patients and abnormal lipids in 66% of them. And type 2 diabetes? Glad you asked. A stunning 95% of type 2 diabetes was reversed. By trial's end, these patients had a median A1C of only 5.3% without medications. Once again, this would classify these patients as non-diabetic. That surgery can reverse type 2 diabetes has been known since 1992, when a study found that patients who had undergone bariatric surgery achieved normal blood glucose within 2 months and maintained it for 10 years. The benefits extended far beyond their body weight. Many of their metabolic abnormalities normalized as well. Sky-high insulin levels plummeted to normal levels. Blood glucose dropped in half. Fasting insulin, a marker of insulin resistance, dropped 73%. What lesson can be learned from this? The problem was not that the disease was chronic and progressive. The problem was that our treatment didn't really work. We had seen the great enemy, and it was ourselves. The startling success of bariatric surgery led to a 2016 joint statement supported by 45 diabetes organizations, including such influential groups as the American Diabetes Association, the International Diabetes Federation, and Diabetes UK, that surgery be recommended as a first-line treatment option for patients with type 2 diabetes and a body mass index greater than 40, regardless of other lifestyle interventions. At a body mass index between 35 and 40, they suggested, surgery should be considered only if other lifestyle options failed. With this endorsement, these groups have tacitly admitted that standard medications and lifestyle treatments, low-fat, low-calorie diets, have failed to effectively treat this disease. Why surgery is not usually the right solution. Despite the success of all these surgeries, I don't generally recommend them for a variety of reasons. Surgery carries a heavy price, both financially and physiologically, due to many surgical complications. Most importantly, though, we can derive all these amazing benefits without surgery. We only need to understand why surgery succeeds where other approaches fail, and how we can duplicate its results. Many theories have tried to explain this. The foregut hypothesis suggested that removing part of the healthy stomach is responsible for the myriad of benefits. The stomach secretes many hormones, including incretins, peptide YY, and ghrelin. Removing the stomach reduces all of these hormones and perhaps others not yet identified. However, it soon became obvious that this explanation cannot possibly be correct. The less invasive gastric banding does not remove any part of the stomach, but reverses type 2 diabetes as effectively as the Roux-en-Y procedure in the short term. Indeed, the different bariatric procedures do not differ substantially in their ability to reduce insulin resistance, despite the wide variation in stomach removal or rerouting of the small intestines. The only variable that matters is how much weight is lost. The foregut hypothesis also failed to explain why type 2 diabetes often recurs years later, since the stomach does not regenerate the ability to secrete these hormones. This reasoning proves what should have been a rather obvious point, that removing the healthy stomach doesn't truly have any benefits. The fat mass hypothesis suggests that the loss of the fat tissue leads to the beneficial effects. Adipocytes actively secrete many different hormones, and perhaps one or several of these is the problem. For example, adipocytes convert testosterone into estrogen, leading to the familiar phenomenon of man boobs in obesity. So adipocytes are not metabolically inert, but active hormonal players. This thinking presents two problems. First, type 2 diabetes disappears within weeks of surgery, long before any substantial loss of fatty mass. Second, liposuction removes fat, but fails to provide any metabolic benefit. It does not significantly improve blood glucose readings or any measurable metabolic markers. It offers only cosmetic benefits. There is no real magic here. The mechanism of benefit is the simplest and most obvious. All bariatric surgeries are effective because they create a sudden, severe caloric reduction. The simplest explanation is often the correct one. Remember that insulin resistance is an overflow phenomenon. Our liver cells are jammed full of sugar and fat, like an overinflated balloon. Insulin signals the cell to open up the gates to allow glucose inside. The overflowing liver cells turn away the glucose, leaving it in the blood and triggering the phenomenon known as insulin resistance. To decompress the congested liver, newly created fat is exported to other organs, clogging up the pancreas and leading to lowered insulin secretion. With sudden, severe caloric restriction, our body depletes liver glycogen stores in about 24 hours. Once that's gone, we are forced to burn fat for energy. The body burns the fat from the liver and other organs preferentially because it is more accessible than the fat stored in the adipocytes. Recall that this fat, contained within and around the abdominal organs, causes metabolic syndrome. Therefore, removing this ectopic, visceral fat reverses type 2 diabetes long before any substantial reduction in overall fat mass becomes apparent. Diabetes reverses within weeks of surgery, even though patients are still hundreds of pounds overweight. Removing fat from the organs leads to rapid metabolic improvement. Removing excess fat from the pancreas resolves beta cell dysfunction. As insulin secretion returns to normal, blood glucose begins to drop. Removing the excess fat from the liver, like deflating that overinflated balloon, reverses insulin resistance. The dual defects of type 2 diabetes resolve. What these surgical success stories show conclusively is that type 2 diabetes is a fully reversible disease. We have been led to believe that type 2 diabetes progresses inevitably, like age. But this belief is simply not true. Let's juxtapose two facts. Type 2 diabetes is a largely reversible disease. With the standard treatments of low-calorie, reduced-fat diets and medications, including insulin, type 2 diabetes progresses. The only logical conclusion here, as bizarre as it may sound, is that most cases of type 2 diabetes are being treated incorrectly. That is why type 2 diabetes has become an epidemic. The problem is not the disease, but our treatment and understanding of it. The reason that sudden severe caloric restriction reverses type 2 diabetes is that it forces the body to burn the fat stored within the bloated liver and pancreas cells. The body simply burns off the excess sugar and fat that causes the type 2 diabetes, and the disease goes into remission. So, is there another way to burn off all that ectopic fat without the cost and complications of surgery? As it happens, there is. As Dr. Sarah Hallberg and Dr. Osama Hamdi wrote in the New York Times, before you spend $26,000 on weight loss surgery, do this. What is the solution they're talking about? Simple. A low-carbohydrate diet. Chapter 14. Carbohydrate-reduced diets. If I had a flood in my house, I would not spend day after day, week after week, and year after year, buying buckets, mops, and towels. I would not be inventing different types of buckets and more expensive mops or drainage systems to ensure the water drained away quickly. I would find the source of the water and turn it off. Dr. Werner Wheelock. In 2015, newspapers reported that a 3-year-old Texan girl had become the world's youngest person to develop type 2 diabetes. Yes, 3 years old. At birth, she weighed 3.2 kilograms, 7 pounds. At 3.5 years old, she weighed 35 kilograms, 77 pounds, and presented to the hospital with the classic symptoms of diabetes, frequent urination and thirst. Given her age, medical staff naturally assumed she had type 1 diabetes, the so-called early onset or juvenile diabetes. However, her obesity suggested type 2 diabetes, and further testing confirmed it. There was no family history of diabetes. Instead, the problem was her diet, which consisted mostly of candy, sugary drinks, and fast food. The toddler was initially placed on medications, but with the proper diet, she lost 25% of her original weight and was able to stop taking all her medications as her blood glucose levels returned to normal. 2 years later, this little girl's diabetes was cured. Here's another heartwarming story. My friend Betsy, not her real name, was a 27-year-old medical researcher in a local academic hospital. At her yearly checkup, she was overweight, but otherwise felt well. She was shocked to learn that screening blood tests revealed a hemoglobin A1C of 10.4, which meant she had severe type 2 diabetes. Alarmed, her physician immediately prescribed 3 different medications in line with the Canadian Diabetes Association guidelines. Betsy was further warned that she would likely need medications for the rest of her life, and eventually, insulin. She heard that type 2 diabetes is chronic and progressive, a disease without hope of a cure. Horrified, Betsy rejected this dire prediction and took none of the medications. She did some research, started a very low-carbohydrate diet called a ketogenic diet, and immediately noticed a difference. Her weight dropped. Her waist size shrank. 3 months later, her A1C level was only 5.5%, without any medications at all. She looked and felt great. By definition, she no longer had type 2 diabetes. Again, Betsy's diabetes was cured. So much for a chronic and progressive disease. In both cases, dietary changes addressed the root cause and reversed the diabetes. That's no surprise. All diabetes associations throughout the world recommend starting treatment with diet and lifestyle changes before prescribing medication. But what's the best diet to follow for type 2 diabetes? Unfortunately, that's a more difficult question. The failure of the low-fat diet. The World Health Organization released its first global report on diabetes in 2016, but it only provides vague, general dietary guidelines for treatment. It says that added sugars should be reduced to less than 10% of total calories, but mentions nothing about optimal macronutrient composition. There is no guidance to follow a low or high carbohydrate, low or high fat, low or high protein diet. Similarly, the American Diabetes Association 2016 Standards of Care document, Diabetes Care, declined to recommend any particular diet. Both of these organizations have quietly backed away from the ineffective, low-fat, calorie-restriction dietary advice they had promoted for 40 years, tacitly acknowledging its futility. Fatty but delicious foods, such as butter, full-fat cheese, and cream, were said to clog arteries and cause heart disease, So the Dietary Guidelines for Americans in 1977 recommended that people eat 50 to 60% of their total daily calories as carbohydrates in order to lower dietary fat. Even as recently as 2008, the American Diabetes Association position paper recommended a minimum daily carbohydrate intake of 130 grams. In North America, these carbohydrates tend to be highly refined wheat and corn products, such as sugar, bread, and pasta. In 1999, at the height of the low-fat mania, the landmark Lyon Diet Heart Study sent shockwaves through the medical community. Patients who had suffered heart attacks were randomly assigned to the American Heart Association's low-fat diet or the high-fat Mediterranean diet, which was full of olive oil, nuts, and avocados. The results were almost unbelievable. The Mediterranean diet reduced heart disease and death by a jaw-dropping 75%. It should hardly have come as a surprise, as it confirmed what used to be called the French paradox. In the 1980s and 1990s, people in France were eating saturated fat like it was going out of style. Yet their death rate from cardiovascular disease was less than half what it was in the United States. If saturated fat clogged arteries and led inexorably to heart disease, then how could the French possibly eat more fat and have less heart disease? The answer, in hindsight, is pretty obvious. Eating saturated fat does not lead to cardiovascular disease. The cardiovascular benefits of the relatively high-fat Mediterranean diet have since been replicated many times. Most recently, the 2013 PREDIMED study confirmed that patients on the Mediterranean diet reduced their rate of heart disease and death. Further comparison of different dietary habits in the countries of Europe in 2012 shows that higher saturated fat intake is associated with less heart disease. A 2009 meta-analysis demonstrated that saturated fat had no correlation to heart disease and offers slight protection against stroke. In Japan, this protection against stroke has also been noted. Slowly but steadily, the realization that diets high in natural fats are intrinsically healthy is gaining ground. See figure 14.1 in the supplementary PDF. Why to eat healthy fat? The nutritional landscape began to change in the mid-2000s as foods high in monounsaturated fats began to be recommended for heart health. Avocados, once regarded as dangerous due to their high fat content, are now highly valued as a healthy superfood. Similarly, eating more nuts is routinely linked to better health outcomes. Daily nut consumption is associated with a 35% decreased risk of heart attack. Fatty cold water fish, which are rich in omega-3 oil, are also considered extremely protective against heart disease. Northern communities, where native people have eaten a traditional diet full of whale and seal blubber, as well as fatty fish, have had virtually no cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes. The town of Upernavik, Greenland, for example, reported only a single case of type 2 diabetes between 1950 and 1974. In comparison, about 13% of Americans currently suffer from this disease. High blood levels of trans-palmitoleic acid from full-fat dairy are associated with a 60% reduction in the incidence of type 2 diabetes. It also improves HDL, triglyceride levels, and lowers markers of inflammation, such as high-sensitivity C-reactive protein. Egg yolks, once reviled as being high in cholesterol, have been vindicated. Studies now conclude that eating eggs, even daily, does not raise the risk of heart disease. In fact, consuming lots of eggs reduces the risk of diabetes by 42%. Why is fat useful in preventing and treating type 2 diabetes? Remember that of the three macronutrients, dietary fat stimulates insulin the least. Pure fats, such as butter and olive oil, stimulate almost no insulin release, Therefore, replacing refined carbohydrates with natural fats is a simple, natural